Welcome to the Daily Friend Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Ms. Sarah Gon. Sarah, how are you this fine Thursday?
Hi, yes, good, thank you.
And Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you this fine Thursday?
Well, I wonder if it is a fine Thursday, but I'm certainly in it, so we'll see how it goes.
I don't know.
There's still lots of it to come.
No, sure enough, but it's towards the end of the week. December is soon upon us, and many good things are happening. Right, let's get into our first story today, and that is the ongoing battle between us and the entire finance industry. There's been an interesting development. Now, of course, we've been warning a lot about the dangers of prescribed assets. That is where the government forces you to invest your pension or your savings in particular areas, usually state-owned enterprises, in order to fund them. And it promises a return, but ultimately it's not a real promise because, you know, there's no one to really hold them to account if they don't. The government, there's been a new development in this field. And Herman, why don't you lay out exactly what happened? And some of the positive signs we're actually seeing from the industry.
Yes. Now, I must say this is a story with a few, you know, origins and a few contributory streams, as it were, before it becomes the river that we are now going to embark down, hopefully with several paddles at hand and avoid any excrement-based creeks. So this is part of the question about the ANC having run out of assets and how its preparation without compensation really is just a fig leaf for asset grabs and a second wave of state capture. The ANC the ANC has been functioning on the funneling of money away from the state and the government from you know, taxation and so on as its main income, and now having stripped the fiscal cupboard bare, they are in a desperate scramble for cash. They need cash to lubricate and keep going their vast patronage network. So voila, we arrive at expropriation without compensation, and people must, for the upteenth time we repeat this, must not make the mistake of thinking EWC, expropriation without compensation, is about land. It is not. Land is being used as an emotive wedge to drive this thing forward so that assets can be made available to the government via, or to the ANC via the government, so as to keep itself in existence and functioning, its patronage network being its fundamental unifying glue. So we end up in a situation where prescribed assets, where the government essentially instructs investors and investment fund managers where to invest the money of their clients. And this is something that the Institute has been fighting against for a couple of years now. And it really came to a bit of a heated point earlier this year. And for those of you keeping score at home, be in no, you know, position of fear, we will turn up the heat shortly again. And part of that heat being turned up is us crossing swords with the corporate investment industry, the, you know, corporate SA, who have, like the mining sector about a decade ago, really been naive in almost collaborating with the ANC down this path of prescribed assets. And the problem we have here is that business people are working with politicians, thinking those politicians think like business people. If you're going to work with an ideologue, you must understand their ideology, and business and corporate South Africa seems not to be able to do so in the main. And that is why we've seen negotiations behind closed doors, kept silent from clients and the general public, between the government and financial institutions in the corporate sector about how the pensions and savings and assets and, of ordinary South Africans can be made available to the government to quote unquote fund investment projects. But if you look deeper, it is actually to fund the ANC's patronage network. And part of these negotiations have been a few accidental telltale signs of you know, some dark dealings and grubby little stitch-ups going on. A few months ago, I asked Leon Comfort, the CEO of ASISA, the Association for Savings and Investments in South Africa, whether they are negotiating with the government about giving access to clients' funds for the funding of government expenditure. And he kind of prevaricated and tried to dodge the question. And then it became clear that, yes, they are negotiating with these. And then about a week ago, I think, there was this weird occurrence where a very, very sensible policy came out of a circular published by the South African Reserve Bank, which essentially would have meant the lifting of the cap on how much money investors can take from, can take on behalf of their clients and invest overseas. Now, if you're in South Africa and you realize that the JSE hasn't made you money in 10 years, and that we're likely to underperform emerging markets economically by a further 50% in the coming years, then you start thinking that, you know, perhaps my money should be overseas, and I think you would be right. So part of the whole investment regulation scheme in South Africa is the fact that only a set percentage of your money can be moved offshore. And the circular published by the South African Reserve Bank a week ago seemed to almost actually lift the cap on how much money people can invest offshore. And not only did it not, you know, lift the cap to a higher limit, it lifted the cap from what we could understand from the circular to essentially mean that you can put any of your, there would be no limit on what you can move offshore in terms of investments. And this was something very odd. And we spoke to a few economists and finance people, and they made it clear to us, and I think they've since been proven right, that this was an accidental move. And from our analysis, this seems to be a preemptive or a premature move that should actually in reality form part of a government private sector stitch up quid pro quo, where access to pension funds and savings are allowed, but in return for the adjustment of some of these caps and limitations on investment destinations. You know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. So when this circular came out and lifted this cap for offshore investment, it immediately sent alarm bells pealing, because this is so out of character, so prudent, so sensible, so pragmatic, that we had to know it's a mistake on the government side. So a few things happened since then. I'm moving towards concluding this whole thing. A few things have happened since then. Firstly, that circular needed ratification by the FSCA, which it did not get. So while that circular from the Reserve Bank nominally lifted the cap on offshore investments, it couldn't be traded on because the association body hadn't approved it as something that could be traded on. So while the Saab circular indicated that offshore limits are gone, no asset manager or investment manager could actually act on that because the FSCA, the Financial Service Commission, did not, as it were, ratify and that circular as meaning that such caps are lifted. So the industry body stopped clients from being able to make use of this opportunity. Then that circular was revoked, essentially. The meaning of that lifting of the cap was, quote unquote, clarified by the Reserve Bank. And we are now back to the previous situation as if the cap was never lifted through that circular. But from the industry, we have now at last, and ironically from Martha Virzhitska, someone with whom we've crossed swords quite heatedly earlier this year, tweeted out that she believes ACISA, the representative body of savings and investments, made representations to the Financial Services Commission and to the National Treasury and to SARS to stop the circular from the Reserve Bank, which would have allowed savers to invest their money offshore. And she said that she had requested a copy of those representations from ACISA to the Financial Services Commission, the National Treasury, and SARS. And if she didn't get them, she would follow a legal route of a public access to information request. And then earlier today, she tweeted out this morning, "I now have the letter. ACISA misrepresented itself as voicing the opinions of the industry. We will publish all of it late today. I'm still waiting for ACISA to confirm which members of ACISA were involved in drafting the letter. They did not consult all members." And this is an immensely positive development from Signia Asset Management and from Ms. Virzhitska herself. To keep these kind of entities like ACISA accountable when they go behind closed doors and seemingly dishonestly and in bad faith negotiate with the government to give government access to the pensions and savings of ordinary South Africans, that is textbook crony capitalism, and it is a corrupt elongation of the ability of this government, this ANC government, to maintain its grip on power. If ACISA and corporate South Africa entertain these corrupt criminals in government, them with their mobster ways, it will be the second wave of state capture, and they will be placed in the dock, and institutions like the IRR will be there to testify against them for the warnings we sounded and for the questions we asked, and that they knew they were going into this, not to invest in government schemes of infrastructure, but in the pockets of cadres to ensure ANC unity. And the fact that corporate South Africa and Ms. Virzhitska seems to have taken this fight on against ACISA is a very, very good indication that South Africa and ordinary South Africans have an opportunity here to leverage this pressure and to identify those slimy corporates who will be willing, or who have shown themselves to be willing, to, in a dodgy, grubby little stitch-up, allow government fingers to inch into the pockets and pensions of ordinary South Africans. So that whole thing coming to a close, I think this is a positive development, but now we must press our advantage. We've got some corporates on the ropes. Let's give them hell.
I agree with that completely. I think Stigner's move here is excellent news. It's a good sign of resistance from within the industry. And my question to you, Sara, is do you think that perhaps some corporates are maybe beginning to wake up to the fact that they can't just sit around and let this industry body do all the talking for them, especially because it's much more prone, it seems, to making little side deals with government?
I don't know. We've got a way to go in that respect, because we have generally had the experience with corporates of being, shall we say, weak-kneed when it comes to the government, notwithstanding the fact that it is a government that is mired in corruption, and that the corporate sector actually has the power, by virtue of having the money, to actually take on government on behalf of its clients, its customers, etc. And it generally just doesn't. And I think part of the problem is a sort of naivety, that a failure to understand that everything is politics. Your ability to run your business, what you do, how you do it, and where you do it, is affected by the politics. And you know, the politics is very appalling at the moment, and I think businesses are going to be badly affected, and all the rest of us are just going to watch these things crumble when they could have been an ally to really meaningful change. So it's a start.
Right. I think the people's aversion to talking about politics is very counterproductive, because it means that we often don't talk about the problem with South Africa, which is it's politics. And, you know, dancing around that issue and saying, no, well, we can come to non-political solutions. They don't exist. Only political solutions exist.
Yeah.
Right. With that in mind and with good news from the investment industry, let's head to another area of the country which continues to be a source of disaster and also mirth, at least for us, in terms of how silly it's gotten. And this is with SAA. So there was a time when Pravin Gordhan, and in fact, I think among certain sections of the media, particularly News 24, this is still true. Pravin Gordhan is the sort of saint of the ANC. He's the good voice in the party that's really directing everything. And he's just genius. And he stood up to Zuma and he's fantastic and he's anti-corruption, all these things. However, as we've been saying on the Daily Friend for a while, he is, we think, quite overrated. And we've seen yet another piece of evidence to suggest that he is overrated. So, of course, Pravin Gordhan is the public enterprises minister. And he says that SAA has had a big failure in that it hasn't transformed the pilot corps at the company. He says that this is a symptom of the general failure of leadership at the airline and that they need to rescind old agreements to push forward transformation. He says that in the future, the headline that went along with these comments was new SAA. It is non-negotiable that new SAA be flown by black pilots. He went on to say that the regulating agreement between SAA and its pilots was out of date, and because it was signed in 1988 and was holding back the industry's transformation, and that it needed to be revised. And we look at getting the most important thing on the agenda for SAA, which is of course transformation. Sara, has he forgotten that the airline has slightly bigger problems at the moment?
I don't think he knows how airlines are run, full stop. So I think he's either forgotten or he never knew in the first place. It's really Roman Kabanak, who does a video, a YouTube morning shot every day. He did one recently where he talked about the one person he hates. He says he doesn't hate many people. He doesn't like a lot of people, but one person he hates was Pravin Gordhan. And I am starting to agree with him because Pravin was our Minister of Finance when he caused basically our debt and our spending to balloon. He's an irascible man. I think there's a great ego that I am right. And generally the feeling is that the idea of resurrecting SAA is a really, really bad idea. And it's been seen in the fact he obviously has a lot of power because it's been seen in the fact that almost every ministry had money removed from it in order to bail out SAA recently. And that's just shocking beyond belief, because in reality, if you think about it, SAA flying, it's an elite mode of transport. It's not the mode of transport that applies to anything but a minority of people. And to go on record and say only black pilots will fly in SAA does a variety of things. One is it points to the ANC's commitment to race nationalism, which basically is racist. That's racism. The other thing is that, you know, let me put it this way. I think the move would probably do his commercial competitors a huge benefit, not because black pilots are flying, but because if you're only limiting it to black pilots, the overall sense is that, you know, you need substantial training. You also need experience. Do they have it? Have they had experience with experienced pilots, many of whom will have been black, will have been white. There's no doubt about it. But that's how you transition. That's how you transform people. And by saying there will only be blacks is not only racist, but I don't think it does the young black pilots any favors, because doubts will be cast fairly or unfairly. And the best way to avoid those doubts is let people come through the system naturally. If they've got the young pilots to come through the system, that's how it should be done.
Right. And, you know, here's probably what's going to happen if you focus sort of, you know, say only black pilots should be hired. you know, airlines have incredibly tight safety standards. So, you know, they're not going to let inexperienced pilots fly. And that means that SAA would have a pilot shortage because there just aren't that many black pilots. And so those pilots will also probably get overworked because, you know, they'll be pushed to do an enormous number of flights, which will also probably encourage some of them to leave. And so SAA will have even more difficulty turning a profit because it doesn't have enough pilots. So this is not going to help anything.
It's, you know, the funny thing is I remember being on a flight. This time I was on a flight with it was a black co-pilot. And, you know, we were all a bit sort of startled. It was about 1998, you know, back then. But I think most of us have since had the experience at some time or another flying with black pilots, and it wouldn't worry people at all. We know how they're trained, we know the experience they're capable of getting. But when you put it like this, then I think people say, "Hang on a sec," you know. I Pravin Gordhan is not my ideal guide to flight safety.
Right, our flight schools and stuff are producing some excellent black pilots. The problem, I think, larger than that also is that, you know, looking at the airline industry, this is something I know about the airline industry overall, is that there is a worldwide shortage of pilots because it takes so long to qualify to be a commercial pilot. You have to, you know, go through practice and training and get in huge number of flight hours that you can't flip a switch and then just produce this enormous number. And even then, what pilot, you know, it doesn't matter if we start 10 times the number of black pilots that we're currently producing, most of them are going to go and want to fly for other airlines because SAA is so badly run.
Exactly.
So, until SAA is functioning, you can play all the race games you like. You're never going to get the outcomes you want, and you're not going to fix the airline. Herman, your thoughts on this topic?
Yeah, no, I must say what really fascinates me and what I really hope people see about this is I remember a few years ago in the dying days of the Zuma administration when you couldn't go on social media without seeing someone saying Pravin Gordhan for president or Thuli Madonsela for president. I mean, at that stage, simply by not being Jacob Zuma, Pravin Gordhan was elevated to near saint-like status because he was, you know, this was the man who middle-class South Africa suddenly believed would carry us to virtue and victory. And the problem is that is the most mentally and intellectually impoverished form of personality cult politics that I think, frankly, we've had enough of. I think the Afrikaner has seen enough of that in, you know, a Fervorian messianicism. And I think many people, perhaps even myself included, have from time to time bought into Mandela messianicism and you know, saw in individuals the salvation that or the solutions that we should actually seek in policy. So I really just hope that people see this and understand that it was never personalities or people that, you know, with their individualities and attitudes that got us into this mess. It wasn't that Jacob Zuma was president. It was that the Zumaites were in charge of policy. It wasn't that the Guptas stole the money and they are bad, naughty, naughty people. It was because the system of BEE and massive state expenditure allowed them to ride comfortably roughshod over the necks of poor South Africans, where tax money should actually have gone to improve lives. So I really, really just hope that people see that Pravin Gordhan has no claim to any virtuous leadership, and that we can realize that was such an idiotic time to think that purely because someone is Thuli Madonsela or Pravin Gordhan, they somehow now have the solutions for our country. Our country's solutions will not come from personalities, but from policies that maximize individual freedom. And perhaps just the last point, why? Why does Pravin Gordhan say this? He is not black himself. Well, he wants any opponent of this new disastrously idiotic airline to be able to be called a racist. He wants to say, you oppose this airline not because government fiscal resources are precious and valuable and scarce and we need them to uplift the lives of the poor, build schools and build hospitals, or give financially strained people a bit of a tax break. No, he doesn't want to take you on your argument of the idiocy, the ideological and ideologically necessary idiocy of his position. He wants to be able to brand you a racist. That is why he is pushing this black pilots only scheme, because he knows his argument is weak. What has the ANC always done when they have a weak argument? Well, play the race card. So let everyone see this for what it is.
But I think as a final thought here, the glorification of someone like Pravin Gordhan or Thuli Madonsela during the Zuma years was not really because they were so fantastic. It's just because the South African left desperately needed someone on the left who they could rally behind as a champion. That means that when you have to find a champion, the best will do, even if that means they're not that great. And we are still stuck with that problem. It's what's it that George W. Bush called it? The soft bigotry of low expectations. Right. Let us move on to the next topic, which is we've avoided talking about the US now for a bit because, you know, things have kind of been going on there that I think are a bit sort of complicated. It's been a lot of fighting about what exactly happened on election day. And we covered it far too much, I think, a few weeks ago. But I think it's time for a bit of an update on what exactly is going on there. So it looks like the transition is going now very much as in a more sort of normal direction. Originally, of course, Trump he still refused to concede. He's still tweeting about how he's going to fight every legal battle and he's not giving up, and that he claims that the election was stolen. However, his lawyers have had a very bad time in court. I think they've taken 32 cases to court and they've lost 30 of them, something like that. When I think Pennsylvania and Michigan certified their election results officially a few days ago, Trump gave authorization to begin the first transition steps to be taken. So his administration is now helping Joe Biden to transition to the Biden administration. Biden has been very sort of the word I suppose to use is chilled about this whole thing. When journalists demanded that he denounce Trump for overturning democracy and challenging the election results, Biden just said, it doesn't really matter. I think it's just embarrassing for him. And Biden says that that the help coming from the Trump administration now in the transition is sincere. So, Herman, what do you make of how things are going, where things stand, and what an upcoming Biden administration looks like it's going to be?
Well, I think the first thing to note is that the Republican Party's Trump or the efforts of the Trump administration or the Trump campaign to have the election result, declared null and void is they're really giving the EFF a run for their money in terms of losing court cases. I didn't think it was possible, but it's quite impressive to see this litigatory losing streak. And, you know, kudos, credit where credit is due. There are some very smart attorneys convincing some very stupid people with some large amounts of money to give them cash to argue vacuous points of law to win an election that they've clearly lost. So, you know, well done, attorneys, free market working. But the second thing I think we must also just remember, the American presidency was established in response to a monarchy. In other words, it was established so that the whims and will of a single individual cannot determine the constitutional functioning of an entire nation. So the fact that we have ended up in this position where the bitterness, the sulkiness, the obstinacy of Donald Trump has really, come to the fore and caused much brouhaha in the media about will he accept the election results. They miss the fundamental point that it doesn't matter if he accepts the election results. It's not up to him to accept the election results. Election results aren't certified by the White House, but by the Congress. So as long as the Congress and the Electoral College goes along with its constitutional functioning as it has for almost three centuries, the president will leave office in glory or disgrace. That's the realities here. Is if you think, you know, that Donald Trump has the power to withhold the handing over, the peaceful handing over of power, you don't understand history and you don't understand the American Constitution. On the point of what's going on now with the Biden administration coming in, you know, part of one of the wonderful results of this election is that there seems to be a very likely chance of firmly divided government. You've got a House of Representatives with a relatively slim Democratic majority being chastised by moderate Democratic voters, kicking out some of your more extreme ideas in the more ravaged parts of the, you know, Antifa wastelands. So you've got a chastised Democratic House of Representatives where the moderates really have gained some confidence, and the Pelosi indulgence of the squad really damaged the Democrats electorally. And then you've got a likely Republican Senate with a likely slim majority of perhaps 51 or 52 seats out of 100. So you have this situation where you will need forced and measured collaboration because neither party can really do what it wants. And in that regard, Joe Biden has been setting up a transition team that I must say seems decent. Of course, they're center-left. Of course, they're Democrats. He is a center-left Democrat. You can't expect him to nominate Milton Friedman to head up the Treasury Department. But he has been nominating and setting forth names of repute alongside his ideological, you know, or joining his ideological side of the aisle. But you have people like Antony Blinken, experienced in public policy, in foreign policy, being proposed and put forward to be confirmed as Secretary of State. And we must remember, it's important that the Republicans have control of the Senate because a large part of the cabinet needs to go through Senate confirmation. So we are here forced in a situation where a seemingly moderate president actually wants to put in a moderate government because he has no other choice.
Indeed. So I think in conclusion, could be much worse. That's a good place to end. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. We are a bit over time. And so we will see you next week. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone. Cheers.